The case that I made in the first lecture was that during the 1880s and 1890s, naturalism was the dominant aesthetic in French culture. Today, I want to explore specifically how it functioned in visual culture. How can we explain the startling volume and variety of documentary paintings produced at this period? What was their value to the society which produced them? Today, I will be concentrating on paintings, many of which were intended for public display and others which were for more private purpose. But reading these pictures can be a complex business, as I hope I will demonstrate. To do so, we need to begin with two premises. First, that naturalist forms of representation in late 19th century France were both more intricate and potentially contested in the ways which they were crafted and read than we conventionally recognise today. Second, that we need to push aside our modernist prejudices about good art in order to penetrate the mentalité that gave naturalism its cultural hegemony, that linked it so closely to republican ideology. I'm going to try and persuade you that there's interest in apparently uninteresting paintings. Naturalism suited the Third Republic. Republicanism privileged the naturalist aesthetic, and naturalism co-opted the republican ideology. This collusion of interests was very evident at the Exposition Universelle of 1889, midway through our period. The official publication made the Exposition's objectives clear in explicitly republican rhetoric: to give pleasure to the eyes and satisfaction to the spirit, presented in the sentiment of social dignity and the need for liberty, which relies on the fraternity of peoples and individuals. In his semi-official account of French painting at the Exposition, Georges Lafenestre, who doubled as a curator at the Louvre and an art critic, explicitly linked the Third Republic and naturalism when he wrote that, in a resolutely democratic society, the predominance of studies of contemporary life demonstrates the absolute liberty of imagination and observation, a serious and sympathetic respect for all the physical and moral manifestations of humankind at all levels of understanding and culture. The inclusive egalitarianism of such language was matched by paintings of the Exposition. In 1890, Louis Berrou exhibited a large canvas which represents the central dome of the Galerie des Machines. It is not only programmatic in what it depicts, Parisians, provincials and colonials, the uniforms of the army, Republican Guard and École Polytechnique, the iron construction and grandiose decor of the architecture, but also in what it implies about the Republic, in such details as the impressed gazes of the colonial visitors or the glimpse of the Eiffel Tower through the far windows, which you can't see in this reproduction. The painting articulates imperial outreach, technological mastery, economic prosperity, and social stability. This is pictorially couched in naturalist terms. By this, I don't just mean descriptive detail, but its manipulation. The cut-off figure of the North African, just a couple of paces from us. The views towards and through and upwards. The momentariness of figures in mid-stride. Berrou's contrivance of the immediacy and diversity of looking works hand in glove with the values that the Republic used the Exposition to promote. Little wonder, then, that this painting entered the personal collection of the President of the Republic, Sadi Carnot. The values that the Third Republic sought to instill were articulated via a wide variety of visual media, from grand public mural decorations and monumental sculpture, through easel paintings to cheap prints and photographic reproductions, which gave the widest possible currency to imagery. I will concentrate on various kinds of painting, but what I want to convey throughout this lecture is how closely the ideology republicanism strove to promote and perpetuate elided with the pictorial languages and forms that painting could offer. Those might be to do with visual idiom, narrative and action, say, or human scale and detailed exactitude, or they might involve different types of picture, perhaps the mural, addressing the gaze of the masses, or the easel picture, intended for private contemplation. The Republic was not slow to use the time-honoured medium of public decoration. The programme to decorate the mairie, the town hall of the capital's arrondissements and surrounding suburbs, typified Republican use of art for pedagogical purposes. But as it unrolled through the later 1870s and 1880s, this programme adapted to changing currents. These included the shift from the conservative moral order regime of the 70s to the opportunist republic of the 80s, the generally more progressive politics compared to central government of the commissioning body, the Paris City Council, or the varying makeup of the juries of senior artists who recommended successful decorative painters. Early decorations often relied on allegories, which both thematically and visually were outdated and incomprehensible to the broad citizenship that used the public rooms of the mairie. Gradually ponderous subjects, such as lex and justitia, were replaced by more vernacular ones like famille and travail. This change in language and legibility not only echoed the transition from the paternalistic presidency of MacMahon to the ostensibly more egalitarian one of Grévy, it also required a change in visual idiom. For example, when he was commissioned to decorate the mairie of the 6e arrondissement with images of liberty, equality and fraternity, here is the central panel of liberty, Henri Lévy still relied on a neo-Baroque design and the historical allusion to the fall of the Bastille, even in 1887. A conservative solution, surely difficult to decipher for the ordinary citizen who stood beneath his allegories. The following year, a more liberal jury commissioned Paul Baudouin to decorate the Salle des Mariages of the town hall of Arcueil-Cachon, his subjects being le tir, shooting practice, les fiançailles, the engaged couple, and les blanchisseurs, the washerwomen. Depicted in a naturalist idiom, these everyday subjects went beyond what they actually represented, discreetly but quite evidently articulating civic values, duty, family, and labour. Le tir, for example, shows the workers of the suburbs practicing their rifle shooting, but apparently descriptive simplicity is underpinned with ideological allusion to égalité, all men practice, fraternité, they watch and advise each other, and liberté, defended, like their families, by their skill at arms. Those tripartite national values are pictorially prompted by the tricolour of their clothing. Allusions to democracy in public decorations were not confined to contemporary subjects. Jean-Paul Laurens's decoration for the Panthéon, the death of Saint Genevieve, completed in 1882, may reconstruct a 5th century scene, but it is as emphatic in its actuality, aged skin, dirty feet, naked children, as it is in its depiction of all the couches sociales of the Dark Ages. The nobles, clergy, burghers and peasants, from the elderly to babies, suggest not only community, but continuity through the generations. A linkage from 5th to 19th centuries, implied also by the tricolour above the dying saint's head. And I'm afraid the colour has made the embroidery above her rather more purple in this, but believe me, if you go to the Panthéon, it is blue. This choice of colour in the central section was deliberate. The preliminary oil study didn't use it, and the introduction of the tricolour was an allusion to republican politics, as was the inclusion among the Franks of two leading radical politicians, René Goblet and Edmond Turquet. Staffage, chromatics and ideology worked in close collusion. But even the curtest scan of Laurence's decoration would have tipped the wink to most visitors to the Panthéon that this was a picture about égalité. That equality resided not just in what Laurence had represented, but how he had done so. Such public works, whether they use contemporary subjects as Baudouin did, or historical scenes like Laurence, were deliberately imbued with legible values and associations which promoted republican ideology. Mural decorations were commissioned to promote civic ideology in public places, but republican values were also explicit or implicit in easel paintings shown at the annual salons. Many exhibition pictures were large canvases which the artists hoped would be purchased for museums, thus to enter the public sphere paid by the public purse, it helped to endorse the appropriate values. Raffaelli's Georges Clemenceau addressing an electoral meeting, executed in 1883 and shown at the Salon of 1885, may promote a particular politician and suggest the artist's adherence to his politics. But in broad terms, it advocates the democratic values of the post-1879 Republic, freedom of speech and of political association. In a word, liberté, as Clemenceau explains his policies to a crowd of identifiable political colleagues, such as Camille Pelletan and Alexandre Millerand. The picture ended up in the National Collections. But republican rhetoric could also be found, I suggest, in more modest pictures for the private collector. For instance, Jean Béraud's representation of Victor Hugo's coffin lying in state under the Arc de Triomphe in 1885 was a small panel, painted on the spot and kept in the artist's possession. Nonetheless, its ostensible record of something seen is orchestrated in suitably democratic terms. To the left, a female servant or shopkeeper has the same view from a stepladder as two bourgeoises, while a couple of male vendors provide a proletarian presence in the foreground and again add a discreet tricolour accent amongst the black-coated bourgeois. The collective, in its various forms, national, civic, regional, professional, communal, and so on, was what the regime sought to identify and bind to the Republic. This notion of a central identity found its resistance not only in the political sphere or in regional pride, but also in the sheer ingrained parochialism of much of rural France. In 1892, for instance, the mayor of Tréminis in the Isère had to instruct that year's conscripts for military service that there was more to La Patrie than the village in which they had been born. The army was a particularly potent image of republican collectivity. Writing about the military painter Édouard de Taille in 1897, Gustave Lahoumé, a former director of fine arts, took an emphatically republican position. Today, due to constant and logical and necessary progress, the principle of obligatory individual service sees all France's male population enter the ranks, Lahoumé wrote. Justice in military law should be matched by truth in the representation of the soldier, which de Taille's paintings provided. The proliferation of paintings of army life gave pictorial form to the collective experience of young Frenchmen, demonstrated their performance of duty to women and children, and shored up public belief in an army reformed along republican lines. Pictures were part of the rhetoric. Georges Janniot's The Reservists from the Salon of 1882 is a consciously modern composition, with its wedge of open space on the right stopped by the rider, designed to set up a sense of the informal and the momentary, as are the gestures, such as the man with the suitcase removing his hat. In the centre, there, Janniot juxtaposed cap, bowler, and top hat, signifying the different classes united by the égalité and fraternité of conscription. Attitudes to the collective are the meat and drink of politics, and under the Third Republic they formed an active role in shaping ideas about relations between the individual citoyen and the state. The function, or malfunction of the collective fascinated contemporary intellectuals. In his pioneering framework for sociology, Les règles de la méthode sociologique of 1894, Émile Durkheim argued that the new discipline would study l'âme collective, the collective soul, taking as one example rural depopulation. If the population pushes into our towns instead of spreading over the countryside, it's because there's a current of opinion, a collective pressure which imposes that concentration on individuals, Durkheim wrote. Another intellectual, Maurice Barrès, was sharply critical of the Republic's centralising collectivism. In his 1897 novel Les Déracinés, the Gambettist schoolmaster Boutaillet, a democrat designated by those who set themselves up to organise democracy, teaches la collectivité nationale to his Nancy schoolboys. But when these youths migrate to Paris, impelled to the national centre, tragic consequences follow from their uprootedness. Painting, its great goal, the grouping of the human figure into memorable images, also addressed these ideological and social issues. Léon Lhermitte emerged as a leading painter in the 1880s, his work published for the national collections and winning medals and prestigious commissions. Lhermitte's typical subject matter was agricultural life around his native village Mont-Saint-Père on the Marne to the east of Paris. A painting such as The Harvest, shown at the Salon of 1883, gave its over life-size peasants an heroic scale. The torsion and the fatigue of the figures, as well as the sweeping expanse of the Marne cornfields, add to the sense of the epic. But for all this scene's simple obviousness, its seasonal ubiquity, it incorporated fundamentals, hard work, team tasks, the fertility of the soil, bread to come, which spoke directly about collective duty, social coherence, and the timeless continuities of country life. Lhermitte's Evening Work of 1888 shows a local veillée, here represented as a female gathering, the girl being taught to knit there by an elderly woman, and therefore suggesting continuities of craft and knowledge flowing through the community. Unusually for a chiefly rural department, the Marne's population increased slightly between the censuses of 1886 and 91, but the increase was in industrial centres such as Reims rather than in the agricultural areas where republicanism was slow to take root. Lhermitte's naturalism was equivalent then. Observation of harvest or veillée was crafted into a scene either epic or intimate, ostensibly accurate, painted by the local man. But such paintings transformed the data of Lhermitte's pays into pictures to be seen in the capital. They dealt with larger issues, whether the broad embrace of republican collectivism or the more specific problems of rural depopulation. For Evening Work was illustrated in André Thuriet's 1888 book La Vie Rustique, recording country customs before they disappeared. Lhermitte's images were made within and as part of debates about the nature of the national collective, as much so as the ideas of a Durkheim or a Barrès. The Republic played up its modern scientific identity as it sought to distance itself from its political rivals, the monarchy and the Catholic Church, to pitch their hierarchy and superstition into the past while projecting its own commitment to change and progress into the future. It traced its intellectual roots to the rationality of the Enlightenment and laid stress on its modernity, founded on the application of reason, logic, and science. Looking back to the naturalist aesthetic of the 1880s from the vantage of 1908, Léonce Bénédict, curator of the State Collection of Modern Art, the Musée du Luxembourg, wrote that one analysed and discussed individuals and social milieu like a doctor discourses on pathological cases. One classed types of humanity. One studied the defects resulting from their condition, their hereditary past, and one applied the same laboratory method to the examination of the mentality of collectives. This methodical, scientific ideal, he went on, applied as much to authors such as Flaubert and Maupassant as it did to painters such as Alfred Rohl, and, he added, the Impressionist artists, who had rigorously scientific ambitions. And this is a Rohl type. Artists were understood to be specifically engaged with scientific ideas of observation and accuracy. This went beyond the time-honoured practice of studying anatomy from corpses. On the 11th of July 1891, Émile Friant attended the execution of a triple murderer and immediately afterwards drew the guillotined head in the anatomy laboratory of the Nancy Medical Factory. And you'll be pleased to know I have spared you that. One of the strangest alliances between art and medicine, which I trailed last week, came in 1890, when Dr. Simon Bernheim commissioned Jules Adler to paint a woman receiving a blood transfusion from a goat in his laboratory. Bad idea. The picture was both a record and a public promotion of Bernheim's misguided hypotheses about mixing blood from different species. Adler's fee would be 1,200 francs, rising to 1,500 if the painting was exhibited, as it was at the 1892 Salon des Artistes Français. As required, the painting colludes with the medical practice, detailing Bernheim's attentive supervision, the stopwatch precision, the up-to-the-minute equipment, modern art going hand-in-hand with modern medicine. Education was another means by which the Republic strove to diminish the authority of its political rivals, particularly the Church. The 1880s saw a legislative programme and a series of educational reforms promoting the Republic's laïque policies. The strategy was to entrench Republican values in the minds of the younger generation, so developing and perpetuating Republicanism as the central national mentalité. Mural decorations, commissioned from the public purse and propagandising public policy, were inevitably enrolled. Edmond Dubon's 1893 commission for the Salle du Conseil of the Town Hall of Maison Alfort typifies this, and I show you the sketch. Depicting the mayor at a prize-giving on the 14 juillet, the Third Republic coincided the end of the school year with the national fête. The painting enshrined a secular ritual in the seat of local authority. Its lauding of civic values, such as scholarly achievement and communal recognition, given a specifically republican gloss by the tricolour of the three leading schoolgirls in the centre. Aimé Perret's The Distribution of the Prizes, exhibited at the 1890 Salon de la Nationale, represented a village scene. Its inclusion of mayor, curé and local notables on the dais, as the critic Louis Hainaut noticed, a tactful harmonisation of local men of influence. Hainaut's hint that these girls would eventually marry, while alluding to family values, actually cut across the significance that the Republic gave to the education of women. The law of the 21st of December 1880, formulated by Camille Say, enhanced secular secondary education for girls and established teacher training colleges for young women. By the mid-1890s, there was an impressive phalanx of over 45,000 republicanised institutrices in primary schools. Given that education and the arts belonged within the same ministerial portfolio, when on the 19th of April 1893, Jules Buisson, director of primary education, proposed to his boss, the Minister of Public Instruction and Fine Arts, that contemporary education should be recorded in a series of five paintings, the decision was swiftly reached, and Jean Geoffroy, who specialised in painted children, was commissioned on the 17th of June. From proposal to ministerial decision in 2 months demonstrates the complicity between ideology and visual culture. A painting from Geoffroy's series was exhibited annually from 1895 and the whole group together in the section on education at the 1900 Exposition Universelle. What an example of the interface between republican policy, executive action, and visual culture. These pictures of education served to educate the public about the Republic's educational practices. The descriptive naturalist aesthetic covered not only scenes from contemporary life, but also from history, as we've seen with Laurens's Death of Saint-Genevieve. Historical subjects encouraged ideological glosses. The proliferation during the 1880s of scenes from the fratricidal Vendée Wars of 1793-6, fought in Western France between the troops of the First Republic and the Chouans, Catholic and aristocrat-led, is a case in point. Throughout the decade, each salon had three or four paintings on the theme, and nine were on view at the 1889 Exposition Universelle. Often large, these canvases made much of their actuality, with their specific settings, detailed costumes, and physical combat. Paintings such as Jean-Joseph Wirtz's Death of Barra on the left, and Alexandre Bloch's Death of General Beaupuis from the salons of 1883 and 1888, respectively, use naturalist pictorial devices to maximise the illusion of actuality. Figures frozen in rapid movement or encroaching from the canvas edges to give a powerful sense of impulsive aggression. And in these two paintings, the moment of, or just before, violent death. Wirtz's Barra is in fact an excellent example of how the same work could fulfil its ideological and pedagogical functions in different contexts and via different media. It represents the death in 1793 of a teenage drummer who, as he was killed by counter-revolutionary Breton Chouans, yelled out, "Vive la République!" Commissioned by the state in 1880, and a success at the Salon of 1883, the painting was first hung in the Élysée Palace, where its theme of republican devotion would have been evident to all the president's visitors. In addition, 500,000 photographs were printed for distribution to schools throughout France, so that Barra's dutiful martyrdom could stand, via the arresting naturalism of Wirtz's picture, as an example to millions of schoolchildren, many of whom would have died in the trenches of 1914 to 18. But the ideology promoted by such images was not watertight, susceptible to a single reading. While a schoolboy might have been thrilled by Barra's heroic example, the adult might well remember that the Vendée campaigns had been a civil war, as had been the Commune of 1871. The Commune was not deemed an appropriate salon subject, but images of the Vendée Wars reminded Republicans of the dangers of extremism within the nation, and that, on occasion, sacrifices were needed to defeat irrational opponents. For monarchists, or catholiques avant tout, it might be added, such paintings recalled that a new republic led to civil war, be it in 1793 or 1871. Painting might be an ideological tool, but it could not be reliably read. By 1880, there was a wide understanding that the depiction of contemporary France, necessarily following the naturalist aesthetic, was one of the functions of modern art. This was supported across the republican spectrum, from senior deputies such as Antonin Proust to radical Paris councillors like Léon Donat. At the beginning of his distinguished career as a critic and inspecteur des Beaux-Arts, Roger Marx wrote in Le Progrès de l'Est in 1884 that we are grateful to the realist for retracing our own image for us and for preparing for the centuries to come documents on the age in which we live. Naturalist representation went hand in hand with republicanism's demand for the scientific, the document. For example, Lhermitte's contribution to the Hôtel de Ville decoration was a painting of Les Halles, the Paris Central Market. Lafenestre, who I've mentioned was a Republican functionary, praised the painting at the 1895 Salon de la Nationale for being an invaluable document, and found it quite appropriate that Lhermitte had included himself on the right of the canvas, he's up there somewhere, as this validated the authenticity of his observation. It should come as no surprise that the work of art executed and admired as a document should be to the fore at the very time that Durkheim's Règles de la méthode sociologique was centred on the idea of social facts. This canvas I show you in black and white because it's so large it's now rolled up. And the next image I'm going to show you is the sketch of the painting because that too is rolled up. These pictures can be quite difficult to see. Pressure from the political centre to classify and record contemporary life led to many major public commissions to record significant events. Alfred Rolle's celebration of the centenary of the Estates General, exhibited in 1893, represented a fête held by President Carnot at Versailles in 1889. At 6 by 9 metres, it had required 78 portraits and took 3 years' work. Rolle's insistence on this in an interview suggests how significant the scrupulousness of his record was to him. Louis Pasteur died in September 1895, and De Tay was commissioned by the state to paint the funeral of the great scientist. This is the boring painting that I threatened you with last week. Just as Pasteur was entombed in the Panthéon, so De Tay's painting went to the Musée National at Versailles, so the state doubly claimed the great man. Exhibited at the 1897 Salon des Artistes Français, the painting was praised by fellow artist Albert Maignan for its detail, which he found morally scrupulous, and of course, as a document. But Henri Ayon, writing in the liberal La Plume, dismissed De Tay's painting as merely official art, whose only interest for the future would be its record of protocol. Ayon may well be right. It's difficult for us today to take such a painting seriously as a work of art. But we should return to its function. De Tay fulfilled his brief to provide a record for a society that found moral worth in honesty and exactitude. Pasteur's funeral had been attended by a crowd of 200,000. Placing its representation in a national museum helped perpetuate the nation's tribute to the great chemist. And the scene De Tay chose not only paid homage to Pasteur, but also reiterated progressive republican rhetoric, as all the public authorities, politics, diplomacy, academia, the law, and the army, pay tribute to science. An appetite for the record was hardly new to art. It had been shared by countless generations, from Egyptian pharaohs to Dutch burghers and Corsican generals. But it proliferated in France at the end of the 19th century, as in other European countries. Semi-private organisations, like the editorial teams of newspapers, had themselves perpetuated in group portraits. In 1889, Jean Barrault celebrated the centenary of Le Journal des Débats, by then an organ of conservative republicanism. Barrault's accumulation of some 40 portraits lacks spontaneity, despite episodes such as the brimming waste paper bin or the man glancing up from his paper. But within his bland descriptiveness can be found figures like Taine, Renan, and Jules Simon. Oops, just trying to point out Renan, who's there, I think. These were all intellectual avatars of positivism and republicanism, aptly encapsulated in this naturalistic record. The following year, Joseph Reinach commissioned Henri Gervex to paint his editorial team at La République Française. A bust of the paper's founder, Gambetta, asserts itself on the mantelpiece. Gervex's smaller staffage allowed a greater sense of spontaneity than Barrault, as if we had just entered an editorial conference with Eugène Spuller looking up from the rival Le Temps and René Valdec-Rousseau smoking a cigarette. Although the painting strives for its contrived vitality, it was evidently agreed that progressive politics required to be represented according to the best efforts of modern naturalism. Individuals also commissioned portraits as records. I'm not thinking here of the portrait for posterity, common to all ages, but of portraits with greater specificity. The celebrated actor Coquelin Aîné commissioned a series of paintings from Émile Friant, representing him in different roles. Some, for instance as Figaro in Beaumarchais' play, there on the left, are quite straightforward, although always in character and precise in details of costume, while others, such as Coquelin as Scapin on the right, deploy the artful devices of naturalism, here the surprising placement, the instant of expression. The determination to record, however, was hardly free from contrivance. Lhermitte's group portrait of the great physiologist Claude Bernard, at work in a vivisection laboratory and surrounded by his research team, was commissioned for the Académie de Médecine in 1886. But while the painting proffers all naturalism's descriptive plausibility, it is quite bogus. Bernard had died in 1878. Yet commissioning a posthumous portrait, however lacking in direct observation of the main sitter, was nonetheless consistent with other objectives: the celebration of scientific progress, commemoration of a great man, making a document of the period, even though, in Bernard's case, it was strictly too late. We can go some way towards explaining the proliferation of paintings done for the record by acknowledging the common anxiety about the rapidity of change. If one aspect of naturalism was its ability to register the rapid momentum of modernity, another was its function in the conservation of the state of things before the processes of change swept them away. André Thérier's text, accompanying Lhermitte's illustrations to La Vie Rustique of 1888, I show you the frontispiece on the left, makes clear that their collaboration is to describe French country life, already in transition for a quarter of a century, before France becomes, as Thérier put it, furrowed by rectangular roads, tramways and railway tracks, a vast drafts board of systematic cultivation. In his introduction to his great project to illustrate the New Testament, finally published in 1896, and I show you a watercolour from there on the right, James Tissot made the same points. Modernity would soon transform the Holy Land, and naturalist methods should be used to document it before Christ's countryside became unrecognisable. Naturalism's relations with modernity were complex then, and the multifaceted aesthetic had a conservationist dimension. The Republic presented itself as a reformist regime, its progressive policies introducing liberal changes such as the freedom of the press in 1881 and the legalization of divorce and trade unions in 1884. These reforms inevitably attracted political opposition, in particular during the late 1880s and 1890s, with the increasing socialist vote discontented with the slow pace of social change and pressing for more vigorous solutions to la question sociale. Policy and legislation were a matter for parliamentarians, of course, but ministries and other social organisations used visual culture to disseminate their reformist positions and rhetoric. Naturalism's inclusivity may have theoretically equipped it to deal with any subject, however raw or distressing, but how efficacious was it at drawing attention to social problems? In 1882, Odillon Redon dismissed Bastien Lepage's canvases of peasant types as decent, bourgeois, presentable, arguing that middle-class spectators simply had no knowledge of such people's grim existences and so satisfied themselves with admiring the exact description of rags and wrinkles. A decade later, the ironic writer Jules Renard made the same point about theatre. Having seen Gerhard Hauptmann's harrowing play The Weavers, he wrote in his journal that while we want to be moved by others' misery, people leave the theatre saying, "Where shall we go to dinner?" Certainly, Painters and writers from their different political positions addressed the largely middle-class urban audiences of the art exhibition, theatre or novel, aware that their work would likely do better if it were informative rather than critical. Just as those audiences, with their own diverse political perspectives, sought entertainment rather than instruction, diversion, not reformist policy. Nevertheless, at certain points, naturalism engaged with and served republican reformism. Let me take as an example the issue of baby care and the unwanted child. These were pressing issues at a time when France's birth rate was very low. Between 1870 and 1914, France's population increased by 10%, while Britain's grew by 43% and Germany's by 58%. Deaths in France actually exceeded births by 300 in the half-decade between 1890 and 1895. Many steps were taken to ameliorate this national weakness. At government level, legislation was introduced to reduce women's working hours to 11 hours in 1892 and 10 in 1900. In Paris, reformers like the city councillor Paul Strauss introduced practical steps through the system of assistance publique to aid mothers and protect babies. Breastfeeding mothers received a supplementary 10 francs per month. From 1885, a woman could deposit her unwanted infant at any hour and with total anonymity at the Hospice des Enfants Assistés, where it would be adopted, a means to prevent abortion and infanticide. From 1893, Paris maternity hospitals like La Maternité and its new wing Baudeloc were required to lodge women in the last weeks of pregnancy. Eugène Robert's marble of an abandoned baby awakening was purchased from the Salon des Artistes Français by the Département de la Seine, on the Conseil Général of which Paul Strauss sat, and was placed in the Hôpital Saint-Vincent de Paul. The naturalism of the sculpture, life-sized, highly detailed, with the baby's movements and expressive face, insisted that this was a marble not of a funerary monument, but of a living child who implicitly had the right to municipal protection and would one day be a citizen with responsibilities to the nation. Installing such a work in a maternity hospital literally set in stone this institutional commitment. Albert Desmarest's In Front of the Maternity Hospital, exhibited at the 1892 Salon des Artistes Français, is at one level an emotionally charged image of desolate motherhood, replete with sombre palette and pathetic fallacy. At another, it is a pictorial enactment of modern welfare practice. The woman leaves the Hôpital Baudeloc, the obstetric clinic at 125 Boulevard du Port-Royal, which had opened in 1890, and crosses the road to l'Hospice des Enfants Assistés opposite, where she will hand her baby over. The picture was bought by Desmarest's friend Edouard Simon, a bachelor philanthropist, who gave it in 1894 to the city of Paris, allowing it to become a public painting demonstrating the city's enlightened policies. Paris also ran municipal crèche called Pouponnière, where working women could leave their babies for several weeks to be breastfed by an unmarried mother in the institution. At the 1895 Salon de la Nationale, Ernest Duez exhibited L'Heure de la Tétée. Great title. This remarkable painting, now lost, sadly, represents the regimentation of a natural function. All the babies are fed at once, they are all weighed, the ward is modern and hygienic. The painting typifies a republican vision of progress, science and reform, and a horrifying contradiction, industrialized breastfeeding. As feminist historians have pointed out, for republican reformers like Strauss, the single mother was controlled by doctors and bureaucrats. The state took over the paternal role, and the child effectively became the state's. Duez may have represented a mundus mulierum, but patriarchal control, if invisible, is the ordering force. L'Heure de la Tétée is also laïque, secular, Unmarried mothers become socially useful as multiple municipal Madonnas, and the painting's prevalent whiteness, to which critics drew attention, alludes not to virginal purity, but to the modern virtue of public hygiene. But once again, even private pictures for private consumption engaged with national issues. Danton's 1892 painting of his wife changing their son's nappy is at one level a picture of domestic intimacy, at another an engagement with the national duty to breed and nurture. I'll leave you with that for a bit and have a sip of water. Another of the ways in which naturalism was so effective an ally to republicanism was its flexibility. Crucially, this involved an elasticity of style. The painters that we've already seen were strong individuals. Nobody would confuse a Laurence with a de Taille, a Lhermitte with a Béraud. But naturalism also allowed what one might call flexibility of reach. It catered for a range of taste. Those who liked paintings of vigorous rural life could admire Lhermitte, historical reconstructions, Laurence, scrupulous military precision, de Taille, and so on. Once again, there was an overlap between representation and politics. The variety offered by the dominant naturalist aesthetic allowed its audiences different artists to admire. And yet, within that wide range of artistic personalities, the artists largely adhered to the central consensus of naturalism. Because painters' means of representation were legible, and their subjects typically public in their resonance, their audiences could choose preferences from within a wide portfolio. The army officer might admire de Taille, the landowner Lhermitte. The naturalist aesthetic thus mapped neatly onto the patterns and requirements of republican politics. As the republic struggled to establish itself, fighting its position against old opponents such as monarchism and the church, and new threats like Boulangism and socialism, its politicians needed to satisfy the diverse demands of very different constituencies. The adaptability of the naturalist aesthetic was enormously helpful here. The state's mechanisms were deliberately used to forward art which promoted republican values. This applied not only to the funding and commissioning of public art, such as the decoration of institutional buildings, but also the purchase of paintings from the salons and their dispersal in provincial museums, which might have equally implicit pedagogical intentions. Thus, when the museum in Toulouse was sent Laurence's St. John Chrysostome and the Empress Eudoxie in 1894, it was not merely receiving a picture by a locally born artist. A traditionally anti-clerical city was being sent a painting about the undesirability of religious interference in the affairs of state. Although I've been making a case that naturalism served as the primary aesthetic of the Republic in the 1880s and 90s, I should also acknowledge that naturalism's polyvalence also allowed it to be used by the Republic's ideological opponents. Laurent Guettard's Le Lac des Chaudats, shown at the Salon 1886, is a very large and closely descriptive canvas of the French Alps. But the painting is perhaps less a celebration of sublime regional scenery by an Isère artist or a geological or meteorological document than a painting ad majoram Dei Gloriam, for Guettard was an abbé. Desmarest's The Vow represents, the Salon catalogue of 1894 explains, Breton fishermen safely returned from a long voyage off the Newfoundland banks, making a barefoot pilgrimage to a specific chapel. Purchased by the state and deposited at the Museum of Nantes, it had official approbation. But it was also illustrated in a Catholic grammar, published in 1915 by the Abbé Pringeon, with exercises which utilised the picture's descriptiveness to ask educational questions. And writers on the left might take naturalism to task for being too unsympathetically generic or tame. Writing for the far-left Le Rappel in 1884, Judith Gautier condemned paintings like Rolls, Marianne Offry, Herb Vender on the left, for choosing proletarian models who were too dull and colourless, given the character of the Parisian worker. 5 years later, Octave Mirbeau, plying his quasi-anarchist views for the conservative L'Écho de Paris, praised Raffaelli there on the right for introducing into contemporary art proletarian subjects hitherto considered hideous, and which would shock middle-of-the-road Republicans. This leaves us with the question of how contemporaries read naturalist painting. Plausibility and exactitude were at a premium. Reviewing an exhibition of Meissonier's pictures in 1884, André Michel explained his success in terms of their empathetic legibility. With minute observation, he makes his figures express intelligible feelings, interesting, easy to comprehend, which leave the spectator the pleasure of discovery without introductory effort. Citing as an example, this reader who is charmed by his book, he smiles at a piquant thought. Exactitude was held up as a quality. The critic Olivier Merson praised Jauvex's Session of the Salon Jury for its accuracy in 1887. They're all recognisable, Maignan and Leroux seated at the front, Volant standing on the right in his usual brown coat. Writing in 1890, Maurice Amel made common expectations about pictures absolutely clear. The natural disposition of the public is to go to those pictures which speak their language. It has neither the time nor the desire to decode complicated handling which would demand a moment's reflection to be understood. The further a work is from photographic reality, the less chance it has of halting the public's passage. This appetite for exactitude riled the younger symbolist generation. In Raffaelli's painting, Félix Fénéon complained, "A man's never a touch in a landscape. He's a former solicitor who's taking a stroll after 9 years, 5 months, and 3 days of penal cobbling." But for the majority, exactitude was the gold standard by which pictures were judged. That fascination with material actuality permeated the culture of the early Third Republic. It can be found in the theatre, in the staging of Fernand Ycre's The Butchers at the Théâtre Libre in 1888, with real bloody sides of beef hanging as a backdrop. It can be found in popular spectacles, such as Théophile Poilpot's 1889 La Touraine, the first moving panorama, named after a new transatlantic vessel, with its wax crew and a ship that sailed past. This taste for actuality can even be found in children's toys, for in 1879, the first doll dressed not in clothes, but only in nappies, was marketed. Not a lot of people know that. Art was integrally implicated in this mesh of cultural understanding. By this period, several senior artists who, as École des Beaux-Arts professors, were forming the next generation, men like Laurence and Léon Bonnat, were committed to naturalist practices. Commissioned to paint a crucifixion for the Palais de Justice, Bonnat had hired Bouzy, an artist's model and former murderer who had somehow escaped the guillotine, to nail a corpse to a cross so he could paint from nature. When, in 1888, the Théâtre Libre staged Léon Hennique's play The Death of the Duke of Enghien, it gave its production cross-disciplinary credence by using the same costume as Laurence had used for his painting of the subject 15 years before. Indeed, the Musée Grévin even had a waxwork of Laurence and other artists visiting Détaille at work on one of his military panoramas, surrounded by his real props. One final observation might be made about how naturalist painting was read, and that is its consistent link in critical discourse, and it seems in the minds of the artists themselves, with virility. An artist's general temperament might be judged in these terms, as Paul Le Prieur did when he discussed Laurence's robust and virile creations. So might individual works. Thuriet found Bastien Lepage's Love in the Village, found in Bastien Lepage's Love in the Village, a sincere and male poetry, which is as reassuring and savoury as the smell of ripe summer corn. At the Salon of 1886, Raffaelli's At the Foundry suggested to Mirbeau the powerful odour of work and humanity. These workers are real workers, with tanned skin, hardened muscles, limbs stiffened by continual effort. Not only did Mirbeau share with Thuriet that allusion to smell, with its evocation of crude physical fact, he also found masculinity in the style as well as the subject, for this was nature seen by a male temperament. This was also the way an artist might judge art, past art, for on his visit to Venice in 1887, Friant appreciated the realistic details in Tintoretto's work, which he found very masculine. What are we to make of this litany of self-justificatory maleness? Virility seems to have been associated with values of physicality and directness, both in terms of an unflinchingly descriptive aesthetic and of a moral truthfulness. Once again, I suggest that one finds in this equation the elision of the naturalist means of understanding the world and republican assumptions about ordering it. I return to where I began this lecture, with democracy. The Third Republic's vaunted democracy offered universal manhood suffrage. French women did not have the vote. It was this widespread political and social assumption that men took responsibility in public life and was thus the voting citoyen, while women tended the home. Even Léon Richer, a leading supporter of women's rights, argued in 1877 that of the 9 million adult women in France, only a few thousand would vote rationally. The rest would do the curé's bidding. Richer took the standard line that women's primary role was as an educator, voiced among countless others by Professor Morache of the Bordeaux Faculty of Medicine when he wrote that she should be wife and companion to man, guardian of his home, material and intellectual educator of the young generations who will be the future. Naturalist painting, predominantly made by men, assumed this schema of contemporary society. Yet again, it was not simply implicit in the subject of their paintings, but also embedded in pictorial decisions. Take Geoffroy's Classe Primaire, one of the canvases commissioned by the Ministry of Public Instruction in 1895, in that tidy example of collusion between political will and picture-making. It depicts one of the state-trained institutrices with a class of boys. She is shown teaching the future electorate, though she could not vote herself. Like the battalion of breastfeeders, she is a servant of the Republic. Geoffroy represents her doing her job, but the painting concentrates on the ranks of busy boys. The teacher, discreetly silhouetted, is shoved into the upper background space. Here, naturalism too does its job as servant of the Republic, making a document, recording a reform, showing social progress, being exact.